Welcome back. My guest this week is the actress and writer Sarah Soleimani, who is known for her role as Her in Him and Her, the BAFTA award-winning sitcom. And more recently, she played Renee Zellweger's best friend Miranda, the sassy newsreader lady in Bridget Jones's Baby. She has been quite vocal about pushing for childcare provision on film sets, which you may have read her. She's written several articles about it. And so I thought she would be a great person to talk to. And originally she was going to come and talk to me while she was over in London, because she's obviously now a Hollywood star. So she lives in Los Angeles. But unfortunately, she could not do that. So we recorded this down the line, as they say, which doesn't actually mean down the line. It means that someone records her at her end in a swanky studio in Los Angeles, and I record me at this end in a little room at the top of the house where my children don't know that I'm there. Slightly less glamorous, but effective. You may hear a slight echo on the recording, as there are a few technical issues, but hopefully only the eagle-eared audio geeks will notice that, and the rest of you can just enjoy the scintillating conversation. Obviously, I'm not talking about myself. Sarah's really interesting about lots of things that perhaps don't affect all of us. She is a Hollywood actress after all. But I found it really, really interesting all the same. Anyway, I hope you enjoy it. When we first got talking, I asked her what was immediately different once she became a mother.
At the beginning, I think, because it just takes a minute for it all to settle and you to figure out how you're going to do it. And there's no plan, you know, there's no booklet on how to do it. And everyone has to work out, especially if you're freelance and you're, you know, you structure your day pretty much, unless you're on a set, you structure your day yourself. Yeah. And I've never been one of those actors who have lunches and coffees with friends in the day. Daytime is always, I was always trying to write, you know. So I always had this niggly, like, should I be at this class? Should I be writing? And that, I think in psychology they call it cognitive dissonance, where you have two opposing thoughts. You know, I need to be with my kid. Yeah, yeah. My kid needs me. But I need to write because I need to progress and I need to earn money. And that, when you have those, that duality in your head, and both are right and both are logical and both, but they can't exist in the same capacity in your head, that's when I think, you know, you start to kind of have mental health issues, because you can't. Yeah. It's relentless, that battle. Now I've had my second child, and I'm a bit more confident in what I'm doing. You know, I can go. Yesterday, I went to a yoga prenatal yoga class, and we all became friends. We were all brilliant, lovely mums, and we met up, dressed our kids in Halloween costumes, and met up in a park for a couple of hours. And it was absolute heaven. Yeah. We all shared. Some women were crying because they can't breastfeed and all that kind. And I absolutely loved it, because I didn't have that sort of existential, what am I doing here? Who am I? Who are these? Yeah. These people aren't me. Yeah. I lost all of that, because I know the rest of the day I'm going to be doing the thing that I need to do for my work, and then I'm going to be picking my kids up and putting them to bed, and I've got a bit more confidence in how I do it. And actually, funny enough, I said to them, because they're all first-time mums, and they were all, you know, agonising. We beat ourselves up and we worry about everything. And I said to them how I feel about motherhood now, which is, I don't feel that I am in control of their world. Even you know, my oldest is 4.5. I don't feel like I am everything in her world. I'm not driving the train that she's on.
Yeah,
I feel like we're co-passengers, and we are accompanying each other in this crazy journey of life, and we don't know which turn it's going to take, and I'm going to do my damnedest to give it all the tools she needs to make the choices and have the life that's best for her. But we're in it together, and we're going to accompany each other. And once you let go of feeling like you're driving their train and controlling it, their world, then actually it becomes quite fun and quite interesting, and it just liberates you.
Do you think that what you do has prepared you for that? Because I think being an actor and a writer, presumably, you know, you can't map out your career in a way that lots of people can, maybe. You can't, you know, you don't, especially at first, you will have had times where you don't know if you're going to be working in 2 months' time, and you don't know all these things. So actually, you've learnt to live with that kind of sense of, lack of control in a way. So maybe that's helped.
Yeah, it's tricky, isn't it? Because on the one hand, it's nice to be flexible and not knowing what you're doing from one year to the next. But on the other hand, you know, kids do need structure and an element of consistency. Yeah. And also, you've got to work out a way of feeding them and keeping them alive, which costs money. So it's sort of an agonising dance. And sometimes I think, I mean, the worst thing for me was pregnancy and maternity, because if you don't get maternity allowance, and it's sort of the worst bit is just before you're about to give birth and just after. And so I'm in LA now, and I saw the show to Netflix, and I got a call. We've been developing it, we're trying to find this lead actress, and I got a call from Netflix saying, when I was very heavily pregnant, and they said Michelle Pfeiffer's read your script, she absolutely loves it, she wants to meet you, but she has to meet you tomorrow because she's going to London to film Maleficent. And they said, when are you due? And I went, oh, I'm due tomorrow. And they went, we'll send you a car. So I sort of waddled into this meeting, and Michelle was like, oh my God, how pregnant are you? And I'm like, well, I'm due today. And then everyone's like, oh, that's so... Anyway, I really responded to your material, and, you know, no one gave a fuck.
No one gave a shit. God, how funny. And also, in a way, that's quite good, because there'd be a part of me going, I don't want you to know, like, waddling in on the day that you're due can also kind of, you know, you don't want to look, you're like, yeah, I'm doing lots of meetings today. You know, this is, don't worry about it. You know, you're nothing special, but actually, yeah.
Well, in the UK, it was more like, oh, jolly good, well, off you pop, and see you in a couple of years if you ever want to get back into the industry. Yeah, exactly. And here, they will be, literally got emails as I was in the labour ward.
Wow.
Hello? Is it a mug? A microphone.
So after your first baby, how soon did you go back to work?
Well, I had a bit of a tricky one because I'd written this drama that had got the green light, and you know, for those of us in the game, knowing that the green light, when the channel, and it was BBC One, have agreed to front up the money and make your show and broadcast it, and this was at 9 o'clock, so it doesn't get a better slot than that. And they'd agreed to that, and they said I could be in it. And it was this sort of standalone one-off film. Dominic Savage was directing it. The only time they could shoot it was, I think, like, it was something like 5 weeks after my delivery date. And I just thought, I can't miss that. Who has an opportunity to write and star in their own primetime drama? I have to. So I agreed, and I had to have an elective C-section because she was breech, which was and I ended up. I said to the consultant, you know, are you going to do this operation? She went, yes, oh yes. And then I went in, and as I was on the slap, I kept hearing her saying, oh no, don't do it like that. Do it like this. Yeah, put that there. Hold that up. And I kept. And there was like the student next to her, and I kept pulling down the curtain going, you see, you do it. I don't want her doing it. She went, it's okay. And she just kept pulling the curtain away. And in the end, it was a student doing her first C-section. And she was rummaging around there for so long because all my friends said, oh, you'll be in now, it takes 10 minutes. And I don't know if there is a connection, but my recovery was really long and I couldn't walk, I couldn't laugh, and it was horrible. And so I sort of was...
How long did it take to recover?
Oh, it was weeks. I mean, I couldn't stand. And I had an absolute nightmare. I the breastfeeding hurt, it was awful. I had the bleeding nipples and couldn't do it, and the milk never came in, and wrangled whether to use formula or not, and she got jaundice. It was all those horrible things. I was just hysterical. I cried every day for a month. I'd open the door with my tits out, going, I can't do it. And they'd be like, here's your parcel. And it was just, Amazon. Because I had so many visitors as well. I didn't realise about the visitor thing. And I had so many visitors and I was hosting. It was just a mess. Not sleeping. It was just a total mess. And waddled onto set. And of course, because it's your own show, you're casting and you're doing read-through. So it was weeks after delivery that I went back in. But, it was a really great thing and it opened up doors and I was proud of it and it got, well reviewed and it was a good thing. It's called The Secret. And actually they now, in RADA, they actually use one of the scenes for their sort of TV class. So it was good stuff. I'm glad I did it. But I think it probably did take its toll. As working and mothering, especially when you're a new mum, it's hard to juggle.
Yeah. Do you think that I don't know when you wrote that drama, but whether the, knowing that you were going to have kids kind of changed how you pursued your career or what projects you chose to pursue?
The initial thing is you just think the world's going to end. There's this time bomb in you and you're like, fuck, I've got to get all my ducks in a row. Because I remember doing a voiceover and they went, when are you due? And I went, tomorrow morning at 11, because I'd had this elected C-section. And I went in and got a nifty voiceover in just, in Soho just before. And you think the world's going to end. And I'd had the unfortunate experience of talking to some older actresses who'd gone, whatever you do, don't tell anyone you're pregnant, because the moment you tell them, they'll just write you off for a couple of years. And that really stayed with me. And actually, I think that was I was ill-advised, because people have babies and they get back on and they work and the industry understands, and it's not the end of the world. Life carries on. And I said to myself, right, next time round, I'll definitely do it differently. And of course, second time round, you get the same. I mean, it may be a sort of biological thing of just, well, how am I going to manage everything with children, that you kick yourself, you sort of speed up, like you redecorate your house and then you start trying to sell masses of scripts.
Yes, I think there is we've talked about this quite a bit, but that sort of feeling that I'm sure it will happen in every career, but particularly in creative career, there's that kind of worry, like when you were talking about the cognitive dissonance, that kind of like, yes, you it's important for you to be with your child, but it's also important to have the space and the time and the peace to create. And also for most people who do that, it's not just a job, it is, you need to be writing and creating as just to be you. So, it's very hard to strike that balance.
That space, and that's the key word, is just giving yourself some space after. I mean, for me, and I'd love to talk about my second birth because it was a totally different experience, but after that, I did things differently. I didn't have any visitors. Also, I'm in Los Angeles, so I'm away from my family and my old friends. And I didn't have any visitors. Because no one could come. No. I did new friend. I just said, well, give me some time, and I had a postpartum doula, which. So for those who don't know what doula is, a doula is someone who's there for the mum through childbirth, and they're not a doctor, and they're not a nurse, and they're not a midwife, but they're just there to support the mum and maybe translate any medical terms and understand birth, and they're there because they're experienced and they're there for you the whole time. And a postpartum doula is after you've given birth, is someone to look after you while you're feeding and you're recovering. And I hired this woman called Elizabeth, And she sat at the foot of my bed, and every day she went, "How are you?" And I go, "I'm feeling all right. I'm worried about my poo," because, you know, pooing after childbirth is a thing. And she goes, "Okay, we'll work through that. Okay." And I didn't have any visitors, but I had company. I had people helping me process what I'd been through. And I had an insane, an amazing all natural delivery. And I needed to talk about it. And she came every morning for about a month. And, you know, I said to her sort of on the second week, I said, "I've done my poo." And she went, "I'm so proud of you." And she mothered me. And that's what women need.
Well, that's what you need.
Yeah, exactly. You need to be mothered. You don't want to be making tea. You don't want to be talking about, what does the baby look like, mum or dad? You want to be mothered, and that's what I got. And actually, I think, and also the feeding, again, the breastfeeding didn't quite work for me, even though I was pumping and he was getting breast milk, but I used formula, and she helped me cognitively get my head around how I was going to change my feeding plan, because I'd wanted to breastfeed for a long time and actually realised it wasn't workable because I was going back to work. And the time it would have taken to get there, I would have had to go to formulary. So she helped me. That space. And then in that space, that lovely maternal bubble that we created, I got all these ideas and I wanted to write and I wanted to, I was scribbling away, because it doesn't, when you're a creative person, you can't put a maternity leave on your ideas.
No. And also I sort of felt, especially in the very early days, there's a kind of quiet, sounds of weird, you know, but you've got this baby, but actually the baby sleeps quite a lot at the very beginning, and you've just created a human being and you're just looking at the future and everything's kind of, I don't know, I think it's an incredible,
it's a sanctuary. It should be anyway. I mean, the bittersweet experience for me was that, you know, I had the resources to basically buy a village. You know, you name a maternity role and I hired it. Doula, postpartum doula, I had someone helping me with my other daughter. I had someone helping me with cleaning my house. I had this sort of army of people, and I could because I could pay for it. And the medical care I received is because I have really good insurance, because I'm a member of the Writers Guild here. And for most, you know, for America has the highest number of maternal death in the Western world. It's horrific, and actually, you know, most women need this kind of care. I think it would save a state so much in the long term if you'd really take care of a postnatal mother's mental health. Because it saves money, you know, it saves money in the long term, because you're not having to intervene later down the line when you have problems.
And you learn, I mean, I guess that you're sort of lucky enough to sort of your first experience to be not ideal, but not horrendous. And so you can kind of learn from that and then get better with the second, to go, right, this is actually what I need. I might have thought I needed that, but actually I need this. I remember my mum saying, I was induced and it was a terrible birth and it was awful, and, you know, and then she was kind of, after 2 days, she was chucked out of the hospital, you know. And of course, this is a time where there was no paternity leave, and even if there had been, you know, I love my dad, but there's no way he just wasn't particularly hands-on in that way. So she would have just been doing everything herself. And then when she had my brother, she just went, he was like 9 days overdue or something, and then she refused to leave the hospital for like 2 weeks.
Did she?
She's like, "Oh no, I am not fucking going anywhere." It's like, "I am exactly." And I can totally imagine them going, "We actually need the canoeer." She's like, "No fucking way, I'm waiting till I'm feeling fine and then I'm taking this baby home." And
brilliant.
And I wonder whether, exactly, because that's the thing, you do need to be looked after, and, you know, it's a hell of a thing.
Well, in the olden days, the women wouldn't put their feet on the ground for 2 weeks. They wouldn't be allowed to put their feet on the ground. Everything would be done for them. And, you know, the old school village mentality where everyone did a bit of a shift. It's pretty much too much for two people. It's definitely too much for one person.
Yeah.
And that's the other thing we haven't even mentioned yet, which is the role of the other half. In my case, a man, my husband, Daniel.
Yeah.
And he, I can honestly say, it's 50-50 co-parenting situation, which is rare, actually, when I speak to my friends. That they, you know, you often find out that dad is in the spare room because he needs to get his sleep for work.
Yeah.
And you're like, well, what are you doing in the day? You're working too.
Yeah.
And that's interesting how that gets prioritised in the division of labour, you know.
Yeah, I remember talking to Anna Crilly when we first, because David and I were so, it was such early days in our relationship when we had Zach, that we still were sort of honeymoon period. So the idea of one of us sleeping in a separate room was so horrible because we were like, no, we still want to be in the same room, which is actually quite good because it meant that sort of for slightly romantic reasons, we kind of didn't want to be separated, which is kind of hilarious, but true. I remember I can't remember us talking about something. We must have kind of got around it some way. And I remember saying to Anna something like, oh, well, I took Zach down to have breakfast and stuff and David sleeps a bit longer, you know, because I can sleep, you know, when Zach naps during the day. And I remember Anna going, do you? And I was like, no, I've got too much other stuff to do. I was like, oh, yeah, no, I don't. I mean, I could, but I never do.
That was the realisation
that, oh, yeah, exactly.
That you can sleep when baby sleeps, you just can't.
Yes, it doesn't work like that. No, exactly.
Well, I remember doing a film when I just had my first, and the producer said something like, well, we'll obviously you'll bring your baby to the set, because we weren't filming in London, and we'll get you a nanny. And you know, and he said something like, because babies need the mum, don't they? And I went, oh, yes, thank you. And I was so grateful that they were going to provide a nanny that I didn't actually think through whether it was a good setup for me to do a big movie with a baby and a nanny that I didn't know, because I hadn't had one till that point, and take away my baby from Daniel. And actually, even though it was really well-intentioned, hearing that, and you hear that a lot, these sort of the subliminal messages of, like, the baby needs you more than anyone else, and if you're not present, then you're doing a disservice to your child. And that's so damaging, because actually it turns out that I just did a Michael Winterbottom film, and it was 3 weeks in Mykonos. And I didn't take my baby, and he was only 5 months. We made the decision together, because Daniel is like leaving a job with another mother, because he's done 50% of the work of it. And we made the decision, actually, it's less disruptive for them. They're in a routine. Yeah. They you know, he's around. We've got support. Yeah. They know what they do. Whereas when you take the child out, and you haven't got the stuff you need, you haven't got the kit, you need to get stuff, we might be in a remote village filming somewhere, it's really chaotic. And it was so hard that first time, and I just did it because this director said baby needs a mum, and I mean, of course they do.
And did you ever, because clearly actually you got to the point where you realised that actually leaving the baby with Daniel was going to be better for the baby, but did you ever, like, what was the conflict there? Did you ever feel guilty for that? Or did you sort of think, oh, actually, I think the right thing is for me to... Because I know that sometimes I think, oh, the right thing is for me to be with my children. Then I realise, actually, that's not the right thing for them. That's what I want, because, you know, actually, I'd miss them too much. But actually, for them, it's, you know, I, for instance, last weekend when it was the People's Vote March, I really wanted to take my kids on a march. You know, I thought it was really important, particularly this issue, and I really wanted to take them. And they're almost two and almost three, exactly the kind of age where that many people, 700,000 people, you know, not being able to move, or, you know, would have been kind of scary for them and just no fun at all. And I realised, that was about me.
So you went on your own in the end?
I went on my own, yeah.
And were you glad that you did?
Much better. Yeah, immediately very glad. Even being on the tube, because it was, even the tube was rammed, and you just, and just kind of like, I think if I'd been, you know, because we were, I mean, it was so many people, we were sort of stood stock still in a sort of deadlock queue for about 2 hours before it got moving. And I think just being stuck, just me being there with two kids would have scared me slightly, I think, knowing that I couldn't just get out or go somewhere or get them what they needed or whatever would have been quite, yeah, they're just too wee for that thing. But
I think, yeah, I mean, we took our kid to the Women's March and, you know, it was nice symbolism that she was there and got a nice photo. But actually, there was a point where I was like, if we get kettled, the riot police won't care if I have to change her nappy, you know. But to answer your question, it did take a while to realise that the best thing for the children was to leave them with their dad. And I tried every combination of, you know, I remember filming something in Liverpool and I'd be like, I take the train sort of every 2 days up and down and then take them with me and have a nanny there and then take the nanny up and down. I tried every single combination. And exactly to your point, you reach the place where you go, what are we doing this for? Are we doing this to make me feel better? Are we doing this to make me look better in front of other people, to the makeup artists and the other actors on the crew who I think will judge me because I've left my children? Or are we doing it for them? And the thing about motherhood is it's very easy to mistake. And look, we all have this biological urge to care for the young, right? And it's very easy to confuse that biological tug with the right course of action, that this is the only way that you can manage things. Yeah. And I also think that motherhood makes your world so small that when you leave it, your anxiety can be understood as caring for your kid, but actually it's your anxiety. Yes. In a way, motherhood infantilizes you, because I feel I get detachment anxiety, and I have to manage that because, you know, 9 times out of 10 I FaceTime my child and she's absolutely fine, she's happy, and we have to manage that anxiety and not let it rule our lives, because you do have to go out into the world. And I remember I was at some Labour party too, and I sat next to Harriet Harman, and we talked about this, and she said the best advice she was ever given was that it's not that you're leaving your child's world, is that you're bringing the world to your child. And she said, I brought Beijing to my child, I brought Brussels to my child, I brought South Africa to my child, and I'm making their world bigger. And that stayed with me, I think.
Yeah. She was so interesting. She was a guest on Nick Clegg's podcast that I made for a while. And she talked about how her mother, I think, was a judge. And she basically gave it all up as soon as she had children. And she said her gown was in their dressing up box. And I think that made a real impression on her, because, she's never wanted to be like that. Yeah, it's amazing, isn't it? She's such an interesting woman. But
That in the dressing up box.
I was going to say, how does your mother compare, you know, how the way that you were brought up by your mother, and how has your parenting been informed by that?
Well, my mother died when I was 16, so I lost her as a child, and she worked throughout my childhood, and obviously the sort of trauma of losing a parent is one thing, but it's really transformed having children myself, especially having a daughter, has transformed how I view my mum as a person, because for a very long time I felt quite sorry for my mum, because she had cancer and she had this terrible disintegration, and, you know, it was in a hospice and it was a really painful, slow death, and I sort of have these horrible memories of feeling so sort of helpless and sorry for her. But now I have a child, and the joy of just sort of bringing up, especially a daughter, and just how fun it is and how wonderful it is. And to the thought that she had that for 16 years, and with, you know, she and my sister for 12 years, I don't feel sorry for her. I feel like she had a That's full lovely, life. Yeah. She had a dynamic life. She worked, she mothered, she was a counsellor, she was a reader, she had dinner parties, she loved to cook, she travelled, she went to Borneo when she was 19, she was brought up in a very religious family and she rejected that. She was an atheist, which gave her solace even, you know, the last days that she was alive. She was a staunch atheist. And I actually I feel reassured that if I can, you know, I've made it, and my mum died, you know. So sometimes I think the worst thing you can do, you know, to our point about, you know, leaving your child to work, the worst thing you can do is feel sorry for your child because of your parenting, you know, style. And so I don't feel sorry for my kid that I'm going to be absent for some time. I feel proud that I'm going to be this, I'm going to have adventures and she's going to see that. And that she's going to be okay because I am alive and I'm in her life. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Yeah. But I think the worst thing you can do, I think I realised for way less tragic reasons, but I realised very early on with Zach that actually someone gave me some advice about sleeping or something. And I read a bit of a book and I went nuts for about 2 or 3 days. I was like, oh my God, do I, you know, put him down then or pick him up then or do I, you know, all this kind of thing. And then someone sort of gently said to me, you seemed like you were doing okay before you read that book. Like maybe just ignore the book, you know. And then I sort of thought, actually, yeah, that's the thing. As long as I feel like I'm doing the right thing, then I can live with that, even if it ends up being the wrong thing. Like I can just go, okay, this is my gut. This feels right for me. I can do that. I can then completely deal with what other, you know, like you were saying, what other people might think of me or what, you know, whatever. But like, if I'm not doing what I think is right, then I don't have any hope. If I'm reading something from a book or doing something because that's what all the other mothers around me are doing, then it's pointless. And that's quite liberating, I think, once you realise that actually, I know best. Even when I don't, I do, you know.
I mean, it's the classic conundrum that every woman in this world faces, which is about your fundamental self-esteem. And you know, how deep does it run? And what are your reserves? Because by God, motherhood will test your sense of self-worth and your sense of self-esteem. And that was something my mum instilled in me very, very early on, was that, you know, it's all right you have it now as a kid, but through puberty and through early womanhood, it will be eroded. You know, the forces are against you and you have to keep strong. And knowing yourself and having confidence in how you mother and confidence in who you are as a person, it's absolutely everything. And you see it actually in some of these extreme parenting programs like Super Nanny or what's that other one? Yeah. 3 Day Nanny, which I love, and the you know, you've got these children that are totally boundaryless and just ruining their parents' lives, and it's just this mess. And 9 times out of 10, the problem is that the mum has absolutely no authority, and she doesn't have a voice that can assert herself, and she just has lost confidence in what she's doing. She's a bit ashamed. She doesn't want to ask for help. It's all of that stuff. The other thing that my mum wrote me a letter before she died, and I read it sort of then and sort of put it away in a box, and I found it recently, sort of 20 years later, and in it she says, I really hope if you decide to have children that things are easier for you if you decide to work. And sort of some funny quip like, they probably won't be, you know. It's this idea that being, you know, it's this ridiculous notion that being a working mum is this sort of impossible dance that you have to do, and it shouldn't be this hard, and it shouldn't be the Sophie's choice. And actually, really, what a con are we saying to young women? You know, they're working so hard at school, they're working their asses off at university, they're outperforming men at every turn, they're entering the market, the workplace, and the job market, and they're outperforming everyone else. They're getting promoted. They're killing themselves getting promoted, and they come of childbearing age. You know, and we're saying sort of stop. Don't, well, just stop, or just take a hit. and don't carry on.
Yeah.
And what a con. If we were actually telling them the truth and saying, look, you know, if you get me, if you reach your late 20s, early 30s and you have children, you know, you might as well not bother. They would travel more, they'd shag more, they'd drink more.
Yeah.
Don't put yourself through it. There's also a ridiculous logic that your other half doesn't have the innate capability to care for the offspring that they have brought into the world. And that's a ridiculous notion.
Yeah,
that if we left our children with our husbands, that somehow there would be neglect and they'd be, what are we saying, that they'd be taken away because they'd be neglectful? Well, that's ridiculous.
No, exactly. Well, I think it's very interesting, you know, this whole, the whole idea, I mean, there's so much I agree with that, but the whole idea that, you know, women are sort of physically more disposed to look after children than men are, and that actually you realise that when you do share parenting, and I've always sort of slightly likened it's a bit Stockholm syndrome-y, where you sort of, you know, the more you're with your child and or children, and the more you're kind of in that bubble, the harder it is to leave for yourself. And probably for them, but you know, it's quite sort of anxiety inducing. Whereas, you know, I haven't had the need to go away since I've had kids, but you know, David goes away quite a lot. And you know, the first day he's, you know, ringing all the time and wanting to know what's going on, and the second day maybe a bit less. And you know, day three or four, he's okay. Like, he's having a great time. I'm not saying, you know, he was just saying, well, I still miss you. And I'm, you know, undoubtedly he does. But he's also stimulating, engaged in all these different things. And he's kind of, it's easier the further, you know, yeah. And but that's not different for me or him. You know, that it just so happens that in our situation, he does do that more than I do. So, you know.
I guess I just don't buy that it is more innate in women than men. And this is an example which kind of spoke volumes to me. And it was about childcare. And I'd always, you know, found the childcare, you know, interviewed the nanny, agonised about whether it was the right person or not, raced home because I didn't want them to spend too long in nurseries. That was my responsibility because my husband worked a proper job with proper hours and I had more, you know, flexible time.
Flexibility.
Yeah, even though I was working the same hours, but, you know, whatever. So, but then we moved to America and my husband took a sabbatical, so he had 6 months off. And I literally left them, you know, I had I packed a suitcase. I wrote on this show called Barry with Bill Hader, which was for HBO. It was a big job, a great job. Staff writer, very intense. Mm-hmm. And I left, you know, literally...
Loads of awards.
Won lots of Emmys.
Won loads of Emmys, yeah.
Loads of Emmys. And Daniel was solely responsible for our child for those 6 months. And mm-hmm. and knowing he was on it... and worrying liberated my mind, and I didn't, in a way I didn't know was possible. And there was an example where he, you know, he was going to put her in a little daycare just for a few hours just so she could be with other kids. And he said, and I was leaving the house and I was on my phone, and he went, oh, he said, I don't know whether to pick her up at, you know, noon or two, and I don't know if it's too long. And I went, and I was on my phone and I went, oh, what? I went, oh, she'll be fine, don't worry. And I left the house. And in my car I thought, oh my God, how have I shifted? And it's because I knew he was worrying and I knew his entire focus was on her. And it's the same when you hear mums go at night, you know, the cry, you know, it activates me in a way it just doesn't activate him. And they think it's a biological, innateness. Actually, he knows you're worried and you're up. So actually even if it's sort of subconscious or sort of cognitively not as on alert, it's interesting, isn't it? When actually, if you thought that he was as in tune to it as you were, something in your brain would relax and you let him get up.
Yeah, totally. I think that's so true, and I think that kind of works with everything, not even like beyond parenting. I used to have this theory with flatmates that there's always somebody in a house that has the highest or the lowest threshold in terms of clean bathroom or whatever, and whoever that is, and it was always the person who will clean the shower because they look at it and go, oh my god, and they have to clean it. And I have been the person who never cleans the shower, and I've been the person who always cleans the shower, because depending on who you're with, you're, you know, you could be the person with the lowest threshold. So it's this, it's a, you know, a much sillier example of that, but you know, it's like, if you know, you know, yeah.
We had a style of parenting where we just played dead basically during the night, and yes, whoever could play dead for longer, for the longest, while the screams got more intense and blood curdling,
yeah,
won. And then someone would have to relent and go, yeah, "I'll better go in," and you just pretend to be dead.
So funny. It's so funny. And also just the things, I mean, both David and I have done this where we've come downstairs, the kids have breakfast, or, you know, we're doing whatever. And then if we're really, like, we're tired and we're whatever, like, we've both done this at different times where we just tiptoe off and go back to bed, and it takes a while before the other person's realised. And they're looking after the kids and they're running around and they're like, hang on a second, where's he? You know, and you've just gone, even if I get 20 minutes.
Oh, that's
just
brilliant.
Going to tiptoe back up the stairs and go back. Like, really childish, but quite funny. Yeah.
Well, I think the other reason I've been able to keep going, creatively and as a writer and actress, is actually my tolerance. Right, I can live in my own filth quite happily. And I wasn't, I don't know whether it was because, you know, our parents were they were educators, they're both teachers, and it was all about us learning and really not about us clearing up, which is quite actually some basic skills I should have picked up. But I remember when I married my husband, his mum said, "How can you put up with his mess?" And I said, "Oh, I'm the messy one." So I realised how the degree. And actually, it's a classic thing, you know, of especially women who sort of self-generate their work on their day, that you can fill the day with tidying up around a kid. It's absolutely infinite how much. Could go, right, I'm leaving it all. You know, they're not going to be poisoned. They're safe, but I'm actually going to just work and not tidy.
Yeah. And I'm not like that, and that is, and it can get very depressing actually, because you just go, I have to put these back in here, and as you're doing it, you're thinking, what's the point of putting these toys back in this box? They are going to be out of here in the next half an hour. It's kind of like very sort of, yeah, it's a very silly thing to go down, I think. Right, I'm going to be really messy from now on and think, well, Sarah Soleimani is, her house is a fucking pigsty. So.
these are takeaways from Sarah Soleimani's lessons in motherhood. Mother less, tidy up less, forgive yourself, and don't be afraid of formula.
Yes. Oh, do you know what? That's a running thread as well. Yeah, that's...
Well, Anna Crilly, actually, bless us, she said to me... when I was pregnant, she said, whatever you do, beware the breastfeeding Nazis. And I didn't quite know what she meant until I gave birth. I was like, oh god, yeah, they're everywhere.
Yeah.
And actually, one of my friends, Charlotte Faircloth, who's an academic, and she's written a book called Militant Lactivism, and she has done all the research, and actually, if I've got this right, the only actual scientific evidence is that for every 30 breastfed babies, one less than the bottle-fed equivalent will get digestive, problems, or infection because of sterilisation and water. You know, the water's got to be sterilised and the bottle's got to be sterilised. So, in the grand scheme of things, in the Western world, when you've got access to clean water, it's different in developing countries when they don't. The actual scientific evidence on bottle over breast is so insignificant. Why are we killing us? I mean, you've got women whose babies are under blue lights because they've got jaundice because they're not giving them formula.
Yeah, we were hospitalised after Zach was born because he lost so much weight because I couldn't breastfeed, I couldn't feed him. And then we went through weeks of just trying everything, and it didn't work. But, like, thank God we gave up. We gave up probably after 3 weeks or something. But, yeah, thank God we did. He would have lost loads of weight. And also, I think, going back to the sort of hormonal side of it. I do think that when your baby's first born and when you probably are breastfeeding, there is a hormonal thing that sort of affects your state of mind and your parenting. I know that a friend of mine who breastfed for, I think, over a year, and then when she stopped breastfeeding, she kind of like adjusted back into herself and kind of went, oh my God, I thought that was parenthood. And actually, that was just the hormonal side of breastfeeding. And I think that a lot of people kind of think it's parenthood, or think it's being a, you know, the being a mother. And actually, no, I think a lot of, you know, people used to always say to me, gosh, you're quite a relaxed, I think I'm naturally quite relaxed anyway, but I think that came from just not being able to breastfeed. So actually, I didn't have those, you know, I wasn't bursting into tears all the time, or kind of not being able to find perspective, or I mean, equally I was doing that obviously sometimes, but I think it, you know, so there are lots of benefits that aren't physical. But you know, Margaret Caborn Smith was on the other week, and she was saying how actually she felt, you know, because the big thing with breastfeeding is supposedly that you bond more with your baby because you're physically holding your baby to your breast whenever they need feeding. And she was like, actually, I wonder whether I bonded with the baby I formula fed more, because she formula fed one and breastfed the other. And she said, actually, because I didn't feel so sort of imprisoned by the whole breastfeeding thing, I actually felt like it was a less stressful kind of...
Yeah. Well, look, some mums absolutely love it, and they want to push through and figure it out and get consultants, and some find it very easy, and they feel sort of judged for doing it for too long. And I think the you know, the lesson is, whatever you choose is right for you,
and
you should be supported, encouraged. But I think one of the biggest taboos with breastfeeding, and I had this, so for my second, I had a thing called prodromal labour, where I basically laboured and didn't get a baby at the end of it for about a week, and it would come all night, and then it would, contractions, really heavy contractions, and then they'd cut dead in the day. And I had this very long labour, and then I delivered, and I had a terrible pregnancy. I was so ill and sick and headachy and gassy and disgusting. And I the latch wasn't right. And I knew it from the first time that if the latch isn't right, that just spells trouble. So just don't do it. And I said to the doctors, I'm going to formula feed him because I don't want, my body's done. My body had been used, and it'd been used up. And I was done, and I didn't want to use my body at that point. When I got home, I started pumping, and he got the the milk and everything, and that was fine. But just to admit, our bodies have been through this incredible journey, and sometimes ordeal, and often trauma. And to say I don't want to use it that way anymore is okay.
Yeah.
That was interesting, but why don't we talk about something else now?
How did your second birth compare to your first?
Well, I the first birth was an elective C-section because she was breech, and I had, you know, I've got two friends who are both gynecologists, and they have C-sections, and they're always like, don't ruin your vagina, don't do it, your vagina will collapse in later life, it's not worth it, you'll be incontinent, just have a C-section. And I booked a C-section, and I don't know whether it was living in California and kind of getting into yoga and all the cliched stuff, which I absolutely have done 100%, but I went for my last appointment with my gynecologist, and he said, okay, see you on Thursday, and you know, you have the injection and you fast beforehand and blah blah blah. And he went through it, and I just drove home, and I just thought, he's not supposed to come out like that. It was this very weird physical sensation of like, he's just not supposed to be cut out. I think I want to have a go at this. And came home and told my husband, who thought that was the plan. I went, right, you're going to be my birthing partner. Right, get your hands and knees. We're going to start meditating and helping me. And he was like, oh, okay. Got a doula in. and went, you know, full-blown hypnobirthy, yogic kind of mum. And then had this thing called prodromal labour, where you just labour and labour and nothing happens. And then I went into hospital because I dilated a bit, and then I laboured all day and all night again. And I woke and I stayed the night, and I woke up the next morning, and the doula was saying to Daniel, my husband, you know, we need to break her waters, sort of thing. And I said, no, I don't want that. I either want a C-section or natural. I don't want any sort of fiddling around, because then where does that lead to? I don't want like an episiotomy or anything. And she just said, you are so tired. Your baby has to come out today. Your uterus can't take it. Your baby can't take it. You've got to deliver today. And I said, I've got a confession to make. I said, I don't think I'm scared. I said, I'm so scared about my vagina. Aww. I'm so scared. I don't even know if I want a second baby. And I sort of purged, and she went, good, let it out. And then they'd put a cannula in my hand, because I was what's known as a VBAC, so vaginal birth after cesarean. They'd put a mm-hmm. sort of tube in me, which I didn't want, just for precautions, and it hadn't worked. And they needed to give me just a really tiny bit of Pitocin, which is a bit of an induction chemical. And I'd had this in my hand all day and all night, and it really hurt. And then they came to administer this drug, and it didn't. They needed to do the cannula again, and I got really angry, and I went, fuck. And she went, good, anger, use it. She went, you birth as you live. And then I got angry, and then they did the drug. They put the drug in, and then it was the day of the royal wedding, and someone showed me a picture of Meghan Markle and her mother, Doria Ragland, an African American woman, sitting in Windsor Castle. And I'm honestly, Sophie, I think it triggered some latent hormone, and I just went into this incredible deep labour. And, you know, started to birth him. And then, of course, I reached the point that most, you know, pain relief-free mums do, where I mean, I just actually, I can't do this. And my doula went, that means you're moments away. Keep going. Yeah. And I was. But she later confessed that she says that to most mums, and sometimes it's another 8 hours.
They're hours. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And do you know what? I've actually got my birthing video. And I just want to play the sound, because it's quite amazing that I made, if it will come up. And it sounds like there's a sound. It sounds like there's a sound effect on it, but this is actually how I sat. This is no sound effect on this. Are you ready? Okay, ready?
Okay, yes, please.
Stop it there. That was...
Do you know what? The thing is, I can't... I'm just sitting here with my eyes closed in complete solidarity. Like, I made that... Maybe not that exact noise, but oh, holy moly. Oh, God.
It sounds like a whale being raped at the bottom of the ocean.
But it sounds like what people sound like when they have babies, doesn't it? I'm not quite sure. I can't even remember what sound I made. But I think that you should play that to anyone who's thinking of having another child.
Yes, I think I will.
Because
I might
it'll
my
take
ringtone.
Them back. You make it your ringtone, just in case you think, maybe I have three.
Yeah.
And then you'll go, no, I won't. No, thank you. On the red carpet for, was it Bridget Jones's Baby, you campaigned for creches on set and more support for people with young babies. Has anything changed since then?
Yes. So I held a protest sign at the Bridget Jones premiere with hashtag Budget the Baby, which was in solidarity with the Raising Films campaign, which has done the research and shown that one of the biggest factors in holding filmmakers back was having children and the lack of provisions for childcare on sets, and actually how easy it would be to sort this out. and to put a facility where you can, if you want, bring your child, whether you're a mother or a father, and have that provision whilst you're filming. And it would, often you meet crew members who, you know, fathers who've just are in agony because they miss their children for so long, or that it's actually broken up families because there's been some competition on who can take what job. And the Raising Films campaign shone a light on it, and then it sort of exploded, really. We got loads of media coverage, got lots of interviews. In Hollywood, they've used the budget, the baby hashtag. They're starting their own campaigns to raise money. The actress Charlotte Riley has been a real pioneer and worked really hard in working with George's Amazing Spaces, and we've created a bus that I think is going to kick in April. The Working Title have pledged to use on their films. And Hardy Baker and Son production company are going to use on all their productions. They make Taboo on BBC One. So it's happening. It's moving. And I think everyone is, you know, behind it. Why wouldn't you be? It's an affordable solution to a really common problem, and I'm really excited that can hopefully be common practice.
Thank you so much to the marvellous Sarah Soleimani for coming to talk to me. You'll be pleased to hear that Downstairs is an absolute pigsty. And genuinely, what went through my head was, do I go and record this outro for my podcast with Sarah Soleimani, or do I tidy the toys? And I've gone with recording this. So, yeah, it's good. I'm learning things as I go, which is marvellous. Anyway, thank you so much to Sarah for coming on. And you can see her Emmy Award winning show Barry with Bill Hader. It's on HBO, so I'm not sure, depending on where you are, there are various ways to watch it. I don't know if it's on Sky. Anyway, Google it and you'll find out how to watch it, if you're not already watching it right now as you're listening to this podcast. Next time, I will be speaking to the incomparable, hilarious, wonderful, brilliant woman that is Lucy Montgomery. She will be talking also about LA. Don't worry, this podcast is not getting all LA. And most memorably, about how our kids went to school with other kids whose parents were porn stars and lookalikes and things like that. Is pretty special. Anyway, thank you very much for listening, and I hope you have a wonderful couple of weeks.